My name is Allison Rice. I am the Senior Campaign Manager for Youth Initiatives at Accountable Tech. Accountable Tech is a nonprofit organization that advocates for structural reforms to repair our broken information ecosystem. And I'm so excited to have all of these incredible leaders on stage with us doing some awesome work that they will share a lot about with you today. So I will leave it to them to introduce themselves. I'll start with Emma.
Well, thank you so much. My name is Emma Lemke. I am currently a junior at Washington University in St. Louis from Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm the executive director of the Log Off Movement and a core team member of the Design It For Us Coalition.
Hi, everyone. My name is Neha Ravenor. I'm currently a second year at Williams College. I'm from San Jose, California. And along with being a core team member here at Design It For Us, I am the founder and president of Encode Justice, an AI-focused youth coalition. And I will pass it on to Zaman.
Hi, everyone. My name is Zaman Qureshi. Thank you all so much for being here. Are we excited for this? How's everyone feeling? Good to be here? Thank you. Thank you for picking our panel out of all of the other panels that you could attend. I am Zaman Qureshi. I'm the co-chair of the Design It For Us Coalition. I am 21 years old. I'm a senior at American University, hoping to graduate soon, fingers crossed.
Hi, everyone. So thrilled to be here with you all today. My name is Trisha Prabhu, and I'm the 23-year-old founder and CEO of Rethink, a global movement with the mission of tackling cyberbullying and redefining internet culture to be more positive. I'm also currently pursuing my postgraduate studies at the University of Oxford in England, so happy to be back in the States and in Texas for this.
Awesome. Thank you all. One of the favorite things that I like to do with my job is center all of them. They've done some incredible work, some incredible feats, even just in the past several years alone, trying to make sure that the internet that we all use, that is a part of our daily lives, works for them. And that's just the mission, the vision, the goals at a very top level. But they're the ones living and breathing it. It's really an effort to realize what an internet that works for all of us really looks like and that centers young people. And so that's the most important thing, I think, is to center their perspectives, and that's my favorite part of my job. And that means taking in and taking on those real-time experiences, those lived experiences. So we want to get you involved to kick it off and to show you what it means, that this is something that happens to us every day, that's part of our daily lives. So if we go to the next slide and we can get you involved, if you want to go ahead and scan that code or type in the URL right there.
Yeah, and wonderful. And when you see that, you're going to be asked a few questions. So first, what we want to do is we want to start off and ask you to look at your screen time and share with us what your time range is. And, you know, please be honest. There's no judgment here. If I would do this, it would be higher than I'd like to admit. Okay, so we're seeing about 45%, ranging from 3 to 5 hours daily, with 14% around going to 5 to 7. Really appreciate the honesty here. And then the next question that we're gonna ask you is a little deeper than the first. It's how does social media make you feel? You can talk about all the positives, some of the negatives. We want you to be, again, as honest as possible about your experience and your feelings while being on social media, as portrayed by these phenomenal emojis.
And it can be as excited as everyone in the other room is, and that's okay too.
And as we see the responses pour in, we're kind of starting to see a pattern. You know, there are some positives, there are some frowny faces and a lot in the middle where you kind of experience both. You're a little undecided. And that's why we're here today, is to really unpack these emotions, the screen time, and understand at large what's happening in our big tech environment and how have young people played a role in shaping a new and better future.
Thanks, Emma. And this was Emma's great idea, and I'm really glad that she suggested it. I think that the critical thing that we can take away from these polls is that they represent statistics, right? That they represent numbers, that they tell us, you know, here's a top line, a summary of everything that we need to know about social media, about online platforms, and we take it and run with it, right? But I think that's why we want so badly to center the perspectives of young people, like all these folks on stage, because it's much more than that, and I think that's a major thing that we're here to unpack today. So I would love to know, you know, from all of us here, what was the moment for deciding that, why this mattered to you, why you wanted to get into this work, what made you feel like these numbers were more than just numbers? And Snehal, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that, well, I think what stands out to me from this poll is that, you know, on many days I will veer more towards one side of the spectrum. On other days I'm on the other side. I think that all of us have a pretty nuanced experience with social media. We've seen the positives, we've seen the negatives, we've seen how it has the potential to drive connectedness and to help us bring people together, but also how it can send us down rabbit holes and expose us to misinformation and harmful content. I think that as young people, we've experienced the best of the internet and also the worst of the internet. I think my moment of awakening in relation to social media was definitely over the pandemic, seeing how a lot of people were being affected by the forces of algorithmic radicalization. I saw people turn to social media more and more while in isolation, and I saw people, you know, my age and my peers begin to progressively adopt more and more radical political views. And I think that we've seen firsthand how social media can, even though it has the intention of helping people break beyond echo chambers, actually entrenching existing echo chambers, especially in moments of physical isolation. And I think that over the pandemic, I definitely came to see that firsthand and came to see the impact on our democracy and on our well-being as young people. So I think for me, that was what I first noticed that really took me by alarm.
Yeah, and I think I have a similar experience in the sense that the pandemic was very informative for how I was going to proceed in the digital world and how I wanted to speak up to see change. And it was largely because there is a statistic that was reported from an internal study within Facebook that 1 in 3 girls feel worse about their body image and themselves after scrolling. And I was that 1 in 3 girls. I was the 12-year-old girl who got on social media and felt worse about her body image, was fed algorithmically recommended harmful pro-anorexic content, and I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't know how to continue forward in a healthy manner. So it was through that experience and through talking with other young women who experienced the exact same thing that I was determined to kind of take that experience, listen to those stories, and try to use it to inform action and to move forward in a way that built a better, safer online experience.
Yeah, so I think, you know, very similar. My first foray into this space came through personal experience as well. So when I was a preteen growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, like so many young people today, you know, when I got a phone, that was not just a gateway to getting to know friends. It was a gateway to people saying mean and rude things about me, often people that I didn't know, that I couldn't identify. And that is such a feeling of powerlessness when you're being harassed by people that you don't even know. And for a very long time, like I think a lot of victims, I assumed that it was just me, or I assumed that I had done something wrong or there was something wrong with me and that was why I was being targeted. It was only a couple years later that I started to read news stories of other young people who had been cyberbullied, sometimes for years, receiving, you know, some of the most awful messages I'd ever seen. You know, I hate you. The world would be a better place without you. I hope you drink bleach and die, and on and on and on for years. And what was most frustrating to me as a young person was at the time kind of the default status quo solution to those problems was just simply to encourage victims to report the cyberbullying. And we know from research that, you know, victims often feel a lot of shame, are not comfortable reporting. It also felt so odd to me that we were putting the burden on the victim to do something, as opposed to putting the onus on the powers that be. So that was really what pushed me and ignited me to say, hey, this is unacceptable. I cannot be a bystander to this.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of our experiences kind of speak to how what brought us to this space. I came to this space more from the democracy and the technology impact of this work, the ability for social media to have an influence on elections. But I think that throughout our youth, and when we were young in middle school and high school, seeing the impact of these technologies across our peers, it was very clear to me that like something was awry, but we just didn't know what. And now doing this work over the past couple of years, looking back and thinking and reflecting on the mental health challenges that some of my peers were going through, for example, it's reminiscent of a generation that has grown up completely online, you know, connected to social media, hyper-connected to social media, but really struggling in that relationship with what is healthy, safe social media use. So I came into this space, like I said, from the democracy angle, but Emma mentioned a statistic that 1 in 3 girls felt worse about themselves on Instagram, and that came from Meta. That was an internal study that they did. That was brought forward by a whistleblower named Frances Haugen, who blew the whistle on many of this, that paved the way for a lot of young people to start to share their experiences more broadly at a national level. And so I ultimately entered the youth activism space around technology because when Frances Haugen came forward, there were a number of policy proposals being put forward by members of Congress, by folks who've been working in this space for years, but nobody considered or thought about thinking about what do young people think? Well, what does their experience look like? And how do we shape social media platforms to be safer for their generation, for the next generation? And so I had a number of opportunities to kind of put my voice forward, and I kind of just kept running into these individuals over time. And since then, we have started to coalesce from, you know, a coalition of a constellation of organizations into a movement, which we're really excited to talk to you more about today.
Thank you all. And if we can go back to the next slide there. I would love to hear from you all, you know, why now? Why does this matter right now? And maybe Zaman, I'll go first with you.
Sure. So I think we've met a moment right now. The whistleblowers that have come forward over the past couple of years that have brought forward information about the way that these social media companies understand how their platforms are being used and abused and harming young people. And that's the real fear, is that we've gone so many years with unchecked social media, unfettered access to a connected ecosystem, without actually thinking about the implications of what that does to our youth, to our young people across this country. And so the moment really was paved for us to be able to get involved in this work, because we have lived experiences and have the ability to share our stories. And so the work that a lot of us have done is grounded in that lived experience, comes about because we have real world experiences on social media platforms. Now, when we think about the policy that's being discussed in this space, increasingly, and because of the work that we've been able to do, lawmakers have started to ask us more about what is your experience? How have you found using these social media platforms? But also, what do you want to see change? What are the incentive models that have to change within these companies? And I want to be clear that there are good people who care about these issues, who work in these social media companies. But the incentive model and the structure for the way that these platforms addict young people is deeply flawed, and that has continued to perpetuate a mental health crisis in this country. The Surgeon General, the U.S. Surgeon General, issued an advisory about the way that social media was impacting our mental health. It's why we've seen more of this conversation come forward, and in the process has welcomed more youth activists to this space because lawmakers are demanding more action in this area, and we've been able to bring our voice to the table.
Yeah, I think my organization, Uncode Justice, focuses on the AI conversation, but we're also obviously involved in the social media safety movement through the work at Design It For Us. And I've seen firsthand how over the last year there has been this absolute explosion of public and political interest in AI, especially I think with the release of GPT 3.5 and 4. And we see this as a unique inflection point where we can actually capitalize on that momentum and capitalize on that interest to get real legislation passed and get real guardrails passed, both for AI and for social media. And I think that Zaman has a line that I always like to quote, but we have to walk and chew gum at the same time, as he says, in the sense that we can't let the new hype and interest in the AI conversation displace and detract from the unfinished social media regulatory conversation, given the fact that these harms are continuing to take place pretty much unabated and the crisis is exploding. And honestly, I think people in Congress and people in political circles tend to think of the regulatory conversation around social media and the regulatory conversation around AI as entirely distinct. But in reality, what we're seeing with AI is honestly a repeat of all the same mistakes that we've seen with social media, and the decades of inaction on social media, I fear that we're going to repeat that now with AI. And so I think that the position that I'm coming at this from with my work at Encode Justice and my participation in Design It For Us is that I really do view this as a unique inflection point where we have an opportunity to drive policy action on AI regulation, drive policy action on social media regulation, and allow these conversations to complement each other in a way that has never been possible before, and to really take advantage of the fact that there is all of a sudden all of this public and political interest in how technology is impacting people on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and the interest is not just from all of those actors, it's also from the young people themselves. I know that through my work with Log Off, I always say that I opened up a forum for our first leadership council in 2020, and I thought, I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. I really hope I can get someone from Texas or from Georgia in another state. And the second application was from the Philippines. And that was the moment that I realized this is an issue that has no borders. This is an issue that we are facing as humanity, as the next generation, and it is our job as those who have these experiences of harms, who have felt what it's like to live in an unregulated online space, it is our duty to push forth our stories to shape and inform a better, safer online environment. And I think that what we've seen is that more youth activists have been willing to step up to tell those stories, and people are actually listening. So I think that we are at an inflection point where individuals are allowing young people to be experts in the space, to tell their stories, and to move forth the needle with us as active participants rather than just passive victims of big tech.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all those points. Two other things I'll add for why I think this is kind of that key inflection moment. One is just the fact that, not only are we at a point where we possibly have, technologies like AI, as you pointed out, exacerbating existing harms, like cyberbullying. Just imagine cyberbullying automated through AI, right? Not only are we at that point, we also have this unique opportunity to take everything that we have learned with Web 2.0 and apply it to the future, right? We have a pathway. We have good ideas. We have people that understand how these problems manifest. And so that means, yes, we are at a precipice, but we actually know how we can move forward, right? And I think that that is sometimes understated. No doubt there's a lot of uncertainty about how technology is going to evolve. That's, innovation, by nature. But we know a lot more than we often, kind of take credit for. And I think that that is something that's really exciting to me because it means that there's an opportunity as much as there's also possibility for harm. So I think the fact that we know what we can do and we have things that we can learn from, lessons we can apply, that makes this moment really exciting. And the other thing I'll just share is, I think this is the moment to act because we can't really afford to wait. I think this is the key thing that all of us have brought out is we have waited too long. We have waited nearly three decades too long for action on these issues. And we've seen a whole generation of young people, our generation, grow up as kind of the guinea pigs. And I think we can't really afford to do that to the next generation, right? We certainly can't afford to do that in, an environment in which we have these disruptive new technologies starting to take root and being used by young people every single day, right? So I would say this moment is really exciting, but in many ways it's also, it's different, but it's also, it retains that same urgency that this issue has had all along, but I'm really excited, it feels like, for the first time that a lot of other people also feel that urgency with us.
I always get so excited when I hear all of you speak. It makes me feel really pumped for what's to come. So this panel is called Beyond Big Tech, a Landmark Movement to Thrive Online, right? So Zaman, I'm wondering if you can talk about the movement. What makes this unique? What can you explain the approach that we're all taking here?
Yeah, so one of our core team members who's not here, his name's Thanasi Delos, and he always says that we are pioneering a new brand of youth activism. And I love that because the way that we think about our work is that we obviously have a lot to do to push back against the system. The system is the social media companies, the networks that they've created throughout the regulatory space and throughout Silicon Valley that allow for them to basically just be unfettered super giants in our hyper-connected world. But what we've also been able to do is think about how we work within the system. So much about youth activism has been drawing attention to issues. And while we've sought to do that, continue to try and draw attention to the issue that has brought us all here today, we also seek to work within the system to try and reform it from within. And that has been pioneered through our policy work. We, you know, didn't really just kind of wake up one day and decide that we would go to Capitol Hill and talk about our issues. But we had unique opportunities that allowed that to happen. Senator Blumenthal held a roundtable with a handful of us. That was probably the first time that youth activists had been brought together. This was maybe in March 2022. And so that predates a lot of the work that we were doing in this space, but it was the voices of people in power who gave us a seat at the table that really showed us that, hey, we can walk through this door and actually, you know, take up the reins here. I think that's also echoed by the fact that Emma was called to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee in February of last year. That was, for us, showcased that, like, you know, the voices of young people ought to be taken seriously throughout the policy conversation. I think the last thing I'll say is that what we're seeing increasingly more of is this attempt to coalesce around certain issues, recognizing that our collective voice as a generation, as young people who are brought together by this issue, is so powerful. And it's recognized and heard when we have that unanimity. We're not always going to agree. We have plenty of things to disagree about, the way to go about policy. But when we have that core sort of connected tissue that brings us together and we continue to push the barrier, that has brought us a lot of success. And Design It For Us, the organization that kind of has brought all of these constellation of organizations together, has only been around for a year. So if we've been able to achieve this much in a year, I only hope that we'll be able to achieve so much more in the next few.
Yeah, I think one thing that I want to add is that through the movement, we've actually all found a real support network for ourselves as individual leaders as well. It's not just our organizations that are benefiting, but I think that you know, a lot of the work that we were doing in the past was kind of in a silo, even though there were other organizations, you know, like the ones that each of us lead that were working on similar issues. I think that when we, you know, spoke at Unfinished Live in New York in September 2022, when Design It For Us was first launched, when a lot of us gathered in Costa Rica for RightsCon last summer, I think these were key moments where we actually began to feel a sense of community and began to realize that we are not walking alone in this political battle and that there are other youth activists that are engaged in similar work. And I think what's been so powerful has been that all of us view this as a positive sum game where we can uplift each other's organizations, provide opportunities for each other, really support each other in the personal and professional ways that we each need. And I think that, yeah, honestly, on a more personal level, aside from all of the ways that our organizations have benefited and the movement has benefited at large, I think that it's been really, really amazing to have this community to fall back on, especially as the tides have kind of begun to turn.
And one other quick thing I'll add that I think has been really critical for us in terms of getting things off the ground is as you pointed out, institutional buy-in, right, from really important, influential actors. You know, I think, for instance, about the RT Youth Power Fund, which is a fund to support responsible tech, led by a number of incredible organizations, including Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's Archwell Foundation. That was real institutional actors with a lot of influence and voice saying, hey, young people, your voices matter, right? And so by giving us that legitimacy, that credibility, that has done so much to elevate our work. And so I think that that's, you know, an important takeaway, especially for any funders, you know, in the room, just to say that, you know, getting our voices to the table, you know, giving us a real substantive seat at the table, that's something that you can do, right, by kind of pulling that chair back and offering us the opportunity to sit down. So I think that that has been huge, and I've seen a real shift in that in the last 2 to 3 years, this absolute willingness and interest to want to put, like, money, put your money where your mouth is, right, with respect to a lot of these organizations. So that's really exciting.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you all for those answers. I think, like, something that I always like to use to frame this work is that their experience is their expertise, that credentialing is not necessary when the experience is what matters, that each of these folks are able to look at a platform and offer a recommendation for how to improve it, that doesn't need a ton of background knowledge, that doesn't need a huge study to make happen. And it benefits from that, of course, but that their experience lends to real substantive policy recommendations. We spoke with someone just a little bit ago who asked what we're all doing here, and they explained it, and he was like, yes, absolutely, we need that right away, right now. And it's always really cool to get that sort of validation. So let's get into it. Let's talk about the impact that you all have had. Maybe Zaman, I'll kick it back to you, and if we can go to the next slide. Actually, we'll stick here for a second. What are the ways that, you know, the synergy has helped the movement thrive?
Yeah, so I think building on the comments of everyone, the synergy has allowed for some real tangible successes in the past year, which I think three things illustrate, three key moments that I point to is, like, this is the growth of the movement. The first would be being able to be featured by key national publications. So in August, the Washington Post did a story on the growing movement of youth activism in the technology policy space. And that was a real moment for me, first of all, because, like, all of our pictures were in the Washington Post, and I was like, wow, that's cool. But also, reading the article, the reporter had gone to senators, members of Congress, and asked about our impact on key policy negotiations. And one senator is quoted in there as saying that we were the linchpin in key negotiations behind the scenes on some of these policy reforms. So, you know, there's our public-facing work where we continue to try and draw attention to the movement. But there's also so much work behind the scenes, which is a second point I want to discuss, is our work specifically on the Kids Online Safety Act that we've been doing over the past year. It's a bipartisan piece of legislation in the Senate that has been supported across the board, that we've really pushed hard to make sure that it was a bill focused on regulating social media platforms by design and instituting the onus on technology companies to have to build safer products for us, rather than us having to feel or figure out what the privacy policies should look like to better protect ourselves online. And the last thing I'll say is that when we first formed, our goal and vision was to talk about how we can deliver policy ideas to key lawmakers. So in October, we put out a policy platform, which was done in concert and coalition with so many of the organizations that make up Design It For Us, with key input around what do safer social media platforms look like, and then walking that backwards. So how do we create policy reforms that get us in a place to have safer social media? So we put out that policy platform, we circulated it throughout Washington. Maybe a couple days before, the Federal Trade Commission reached out and didn't tell us necessarily what they were working on, but had a ton of very specific questions for us around what we think about safer social media, how safer social media should be shaped. And then in December of last year, in pretty groundbreaking rulemaking, the FTC announced its new COPPA guidelines that should hopefully go into effect this year, which take into consideration our perspective and our voices. So I think that really illustrates to me the value of our collective voice in being able to channel key policy reforms in this issue area.
Yeah, wow, those examples are so powerful. If I can offer one as well, and I think it's something that is actually a direct product of movement we formed, in May of 2023, so last year, ENCODE Justice authored an open coalition letter calling on the White House and Congress to include young people in AI oversight and advisory boards and to pursue youth-informed action on the risks and opportunities posed by AI, responding to the discourse around the release of GPT 3.5 and 4. We had sign-ons from Design It For Us as a coalition, but also from LogOff and Rethink. So, of course, it really helped to have that community, that network, that support system in place. And, you know, it took a couple of months, but, you know, over the summer when I was interning in D.C., I had the honor of being invited to advise Vice President Harris on a roundtable at the White House where she convened a group of, I think, 8 or 9 civil society leaders. And these were mostly the leaders of established lobbying groups like the AARP and groups of that sort. So I think it was incredibly powerful as a young person in that room to, as Aman noted, know that my voice actually held sway and that we were actually able to have an impact on behind-the-scenes negotiations and wield these corridors of power to our advantage, and not just, you know, necessarily be making noise in a public-facing way, but actually be having an impact and being thought leaders behind the scenes. And I think that people often think that that young people don't have anything to offer to political movements aside from making noise and grabbing a megaphone and taking to the streets. And there definitely is a time and place for that kind of action. And I think that we've seen firsthand how powerful that can be. Design It For Us just hosted a rally in DC. But I think that what's less appreciated is our ability to actually take our lived experience and be the experts behind the scenes, again, working to put pressure on political leaders and corporate leaders to make change. And I think that seeing firsthand at the roundtable with the vice president and, you know, seeing how, for example, Emma was able to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, these are moments that stand out to me as moments that youth leadership has been legitimized and has actually been taken seriously in spaces that are mostly rife with credentialism.
And Sneha, I'll hold you there. And if we can go to the next slide there. Can you get a little bit more into that sort of moment that you feel like the narrative has shifted? Where, you know, can you talk about what the success looks like, what tools you used, and how, you know, everything that we've built using those tools shared among everyone here, how that contributed to that success?
Yeah, it's actually a story that I like telling because I think it really captures the bootstrapping spirit that we all kind of embody on this stage. But I always joke that all of the visibility or the opportunities or the platform to influence policy that ENCODE Justice and probably also organizations like Design It For Us have gotten has just been from me being an incredibly persistent and annoying teenager with an army of incredibly persistent and annoying teenagers around me. So the first time that we got in contact with the White House was when we found out that the White House is working on drafting a Bill of Rights for an automated society to kind of outline a set of principles for the, you know, development, use, governance and provenance of AI systems, not only by the federal government, but nationally. And that was back in 2022. I heard about that happening through an op-ed that the then director of OSTP had published. And I was like, we need to get involved. How do we do this? I remember the days that I spent, you know, poring over the OSTP staff directories, figuring out who to reach out to, sent a bunch of emails, didn't initially get a response, followed up, was very dogged about it. And we eventually got on a call with some OSTP leadership who decided that they were going to be opening stakeholder listening sessions to actually gather input on the AI Bill of Rights. And we were invited as the youngest stakeholder, as some of the youngest stakeholders in that process of getting input to shape the AI Bill of Rights. We're able to talk about some youth-focused priorities relating to AI, like school surveillance and social media safety, really had our voices getting across in those discussions. And eventually, you know, we were invited to Washington, D.C. for the release ceremony when the AI Bill of Rights came out in October 2022. And that was our first, you know, partnership directly with the White House. And that was the first moment where I realized that we could actually, you know, have political influence. And that obviously eventually evolved into being able to work with the vice president as she took on a greater leadership role in, you know, the administration's AI policy action and being able to eventually shape the AI executive order that President Biden unveiled this October 2023. And Emma and I were actually both at the signing ceremony in DC when President Biden unveiled his AI executive order. So I think that it has been so incredible to see how, especially under this last presidential administration, there have been these key moments and these key turning points where we have been in the room not only for shaping the, you know, final policy product, but also for celebrating once it was released. And so I think it's just amazing how we've been able to occupy those spaces. People ask me the story of how all of this came about, and it has just come from that youthful tenacity, that persistence, that doggedness. And I think it really does capture this message of, without that many resources, without, you know, a lot of pools of funding, without, you know, institutional buy-in and support initially, we have been able to kind of just take forward that bootstrapping spirit and get things done in a real meaningful way. And I guess that just makes me think, if we did actually have the same tools and resources as more established adult-led organizations, and we were to carry forward that same spirit of just being super dogged and persistent, what could be possible, right? And I think we'll share our vision for that later today. But I really hope that conveys, I think, how much we are collectively capable of.
Awesome. And if we can go to the next slide there, Emma, same question to you. If you can talk a little bit about what we're seeing here, what success looks like, and some of the tools that were leveraged to get there.
Absolutely. What you're seeing there is a phenomenal moment and a great picture, but it all is from the Design It For Us coalition of members that weren't present. So the beautiful irony of youth activism is most of it happens online. I met Zaman via Twitter or X with a tweet, him saying, "Emma, you should testify," and I thought that was funny, and then a year later I did. I met all of my other individuals through LogOff online. So it oftentimes can be very difficult to feel like we can have these impactful, meaningful, in real life moments that we feel collectively showcases the power of youth activism. But because of the persistence that Sneha was talking about and the tenacity that Zaman brings every single day to the Design It For Us Coalition and other wonderful youth leaders, we were able to get to a point in our activism where we had a week of action on the Hill. And that week of action was really framed by meetings with key legislators to do exactly what Zaman had said, to push forth key policy points to which we were incredibly pivotal in helping pass and push. And this was a moment for us where we really wanted to have a physical showcase of what it is like to have stories, to have experiences that are not listened to. What is it like to be in a state of inaction when action is necessary? This is a showcase of the Design It For Us Coalition, Design It For Blank, showing that so many young people in our coalition and in the world want the online world to be designed with them in mind, for them, for the user, for young people. And it was an incredibly impactful moment for me. I've been in this space since 2020. This was 2022? Yeah. And, you know, 2 years later, I could look up and I could see that we had a physical space in front of the most powerful body in our nation. We had a physical space available to us as young people, and it showed that we finally were not only being listened to, we were really being heard. We were being, our thoughts, our critical analyses were being applied for key decisions. And that was probably one of the most powerful moments that I've had thus far in my life, in the space, and it could not have happened without all the people on this stage, without all the young people who worked so tirelessly to be able to collect those stories, to be able to normalize telling those stories. And to me, it was just a moment in time where I could see, I could really show that we were telling our stories, we were witnessing the collective power of youth activism, And three, it was showing that we finally were standing up to demand change, if not for us, but for all those 1 in 3 girls yet to come, really taking that next step to be a part of the conversation rather than just something, rather than just being heard occasionally. It was incredibly powerful, and I was super thankful for Design It For Us for planning such an event in real life rather than just online.
Chills. Yeah, I always love when we talk about that moment, because I think that, to your point, like all this happens online, those spaces are online, and when we make it human, we show the human-to-human impact that it really does have, where we make those connections and get the chance to have that one-on-one interaction that doesn't really actually happen and in real life.
Yeah, and I remember when we put this up, there actually was a group that walked by and asked, like, what on earth is this? And it was a moment when we really got to stand up and be very proud of what we had put together. And the same reaction we got from the individual, you know, like 15 minutes ago, was what we got with that individual outside of the lawn. They said, wow, this is so needed. This is so necessary. And I think that that was also another great moment when I realized that this is not just a movement or a fight for our generation. There has to be connective tissues between individuals who have wisdom of other generations who are in power and the young people who have experienced it. So it's been very informative and incredibly substantial that I think we've been able to build out that connective tissue to then see change.
Thanks, Emma. If we can go to that next slide, Trisha, I will turn it to you for those same questions.
Yeah, so this moment was many years after that initial moment of frustration that I talked about, you know, reading stories about youth that had been cyberbullied really severely and feeling so powerless and frustrated with the status quo, especially the fact that it was such a reactive approach to addressing cyberbullying. And so, you know, as a young person, I had this moment of, okay, like, what could I possibly do as a young person? And I think for me, the tool that I activated, which I think all of us to some extent, you know, have activated on this stage, is just taking an iterative approach, right? So this is a huge problem. I cannot solve every problem under the sun, but what is one small thing that I can iterate on that can fundamentally shift how we see the internet and social media and lay the groundwork for a broader revolution? And so for me, that small iteration was thinking, how can I create more intentionality and criticality in how young people are interacting online and redesign the internet so that young people are empowered to say things that are kind as opposed to drag them into the cesspool that the digital world can sometimes be? So that is what led to Rethink, which today is a technology that prompts youth to pause and rethink before they say something offensive online. We find it's incredibly effective. Over 90% of the time, youth aged 13 to 18 that get that alert change their mind. So we stop cyberbullying before it happens. But more importantly, what that technology has done is gotten people to change what they think social media can be. For the longest time, we have just kind of accepted the internet as it is, right? This is what it is. There's no way we could possibly change it. But by taking this very small iterative approach to saying, well, here's a very small design change that could actually have a huge impact, I think we open the door to broader conversations and questions about what are some of the other design changes we could make? And what are some of the things we're not thinking about when it comes to what a safer internet could look like? So this was a very cool moment. I was actually in Mumbai, India, giving this TED Talk in Hindi, which is not my first language. So that in and of itself made it a very cool experience. And it ended up being delivered to over 650 million Indians TVs because it was one of the first TED TV broadcasts. So it was a very, very cool moment. But this was kind of one of the first times in, you know, India, and we're seeing this increasingly around the world in the work that we're doing. We don't just tackle cyberbullying here in the US. We have a global focus. Is for the first time people are saying, hey, you know, there are actually really small common sense things we can do to change our internet for the better. And that narrative change to me, I think, is so powerful because I think one of the biggest things that keeps us from success in this space is the sense of the internet will break. If we touch it, it's all gonna fall apart. And I think doing this work and just taking an iterative step has laid the groundwork for this amazing, right? Like all of us are doing that, laying the groundwork for, you know, what is ultimately legislation, right? That can fundamentally change our internet, a movement that can change how young people are engaging, right? Better AI practices, right? That are ultimately gonna make our experience with AI safer, right? All of us, I think, taking that first step, starting that conversation, right? Being willing to take a chance, a small risk, right? And do a little bit of an iterative approach. We then have, you know, ultimately used that to build a movement. Right, a movement for broader change, for systemic change. So I think that that is a really powerful tool because I meet with young leaders and they're like, I care so much about this, you know, technology issue, but it's so complex. I have no idea how I could possibly troubleshoot this. And I always say, start with a small change to lay the groundwork for that systemic vision that you have. Because when you show people the power of change, you can then get them to buy into that vision.
And you taught me something, a framework for how we approach this, which you said we're co-creating tech. If you want to share a little bit about that, because that really resonated with me the first time we spoke.
Yes. Co-creating tech in terms of like the collaboration that's happening on this stage, or
in terms of like the innovation side on this stage, how that looks in your work, especially as an innovator.
Yes. I mean, so I think for me, the biggest thing has been working with youth in developing this technology. You know, I wanted to create something that young people would actually want to use, and I wanted the approach to be youth-centered so that it had a lot of legitimacy, right? I think that's one of the biggest things that all of us have been able to achieve is, you know, people are always like, wow, like you're, you know, kind of trying to push for this better internet. Are you sure that you're gonna have young people with you? It's like, that's how we've done this, right? That's how we've done this, is we've had young people at the center, you know, helping us create legitimacy around that. So for me in the innovation space, it was definitely, it was talking to a lot of young people. It was talking to people with lived experience. It was centering their perspectives. And I think that that collaborative process, that back and forth, it continues. And I think that's another thing that distinguishes our work. You know, I'm a big believer in the fact that that collaborative approach is never over. And I think that that is like a new insight and a new perspective that really defines a lot of our work. So many tech companies, I feel, sometimes just want the sign-off, right? From a young person said this feature was good. Hooray. You know, but I think being conscious about the fact that, you know, that constant engagement is so important, that has been, I think, really powerful in our innovation work.
Thank you. If we go to the next slide, we'll kick it over to you, Zaman, for this final photo explanation, and I'll ask you.
Yeah, so we have to talk about the companies a little bit as well. So this is the January 31st congressional hearing held with five big tech CEOs, and seated in front of us is the CEO of Meta Platforms, Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg was called to testify along with the other CEOs around the harms that social media platforms have caused young people. And I think we've sought to demonstrate the successes that we've all experienced throughout this movement up here today. But this work is not without challenges, and the tech companies present a lot of challenges to our work. They employ thousands of lobbyists throughout Washington, D.C. to try and kill meaningful legislation. And that's what we are up against. That's what we're fighting back against. Those lobbyists are well-trained, are well-paid, and take care of delivering a lot of the comments that ultimately end up killing legislation. So when we looked at this hearing, we thought, how can we turn this moment into something that people will remember? There was obviously that moment throughout the hearing where Mark Zuckerberg, at the direction of a senator, was asked to turn around and apologize to parents who had lost kids related to social media harms. He didn't really apologize, but it was a moment where he, for the first time, had to face the harms of his products. And then there was another moment later on in the hearing where we stood up behind Mark Zuckerberg. And we're wearing t-shirts that say, I'm worth more than $270. That figure comes from an internal Meta email that put the lifetime valuation on teenagers of $270. And that was put in the context of a safety conversation that was being had at the company. So if you're thinking about your youngest users in terms of the profit valuation that you're going to get from them, then of course you're not going to invest in safety standards. We know that if by just implementing even minute changes to the platforms, revenue would not be harmed at Meta, and they could still continue to make tons of money. But unfortunately, they chose not to take those decisions into account, and we thought it was important to call attention to that. So when we stood up in the hearing, a senator asked Mark Zuckerberg to turn around. He like locked eyes with us for a brief moment. And you know, I hope the next time that I don't think it's going to fundamentally change the way that he thinks about his products and these platforms. But what I do hope is that he thinks twice the next time he has to make a safety decision inside Meta, because there are real people that are impacted by his technologies, and I think that's easy for him to lose sight of.
Thanks, Iman. I love when you get all fired up about it. I think it's helpful. It makes us see what the reality is. So I'll kick it back to you. What's the vision for the future? What's next? What does that look like?
Yeah, so the theory of change here is that the platforms have really failed to take accountability for building their platforms to be safer. And so we need outside action to hold these platforms accountable. There are many theories of change in this area about what outside action looks like. Some people think it should be shareholder action, where the shareholders communicate a message to these companies that their platforms are not building for the safety and the well-being of its youngest users. Unfortunately, we can't wait around, though, and wait for shareholders to decide whether that's something that they want to take into consideration for themselves. And so we have advocated for legislation and policy, and you've heard all about that today. There are three sort of areas that I think we will continue to target. But I think more broadly, we will continue to seek input from a variety of stakeholders. We have obviously the organizations that are in this space that are continuing to push for policy change. We've started to engage with folks from across the board, including the technology companies, because I think they have noticed that they need our buy-in in order to not only save face for themselves right now, but also think about what smart policy reforms look like that have our stamp of approval on it. So I think that work is going to continue. We've talked a lot about token seats at the table here and meaningful seats at the table. And there is a key difference to that. I think a lot of companies tout like their youth advisory board. And unfortunately, that perspective that many meaningful young people have to offer are not taken seriously by the executives in these companies. So it is incumbent on us to think about how we can push the companies through legislative action to start to take the mental health and well-being of young people more seriously. And we're going to continue to push for legislation. And the last thing I'll say is that, like I said, a meaningful seat at the table looks like investing in issues across the board. So we're up here talking about kids' online safety and privacy, but there's a number of theories of change about how to regulate the technology infrastructure. That can be privacy, that can be competition policy and antitrust. We have opinions on that. We have seen these platforms firsthand and the way that their monopoly power is deployed or the way that they use information against users. There are meaningful opportunities to give us space in those conversations as well, beyond the kids' online safety and privacy conversation, so that we can actually see safer social media platforms. It's a net positive for society, and I think if you're not investing in this kind of work, then at least buy into the people who are.
Bam. Drop that mic there. Sneha, what about you? What does the vision for the future look like, and what's next for you?
Yeah, of course. So as I've mentioned, I think that we really want to see more complementarity between the AI conversation and the social media conversation. So I think continuing to push forward with guardrails like those proposed in the Kids Online Safety Act and other pieces of legislation in Congress and internationally, but also, of course, pushing forth bills like the Algorithmic Accountability Act, calling for a agency for AI in the U.S., I think is going to be a huge change forward. I think that it's really important for us to recognize that, you know, emerging technologies like AI, as Trisha mentioned, are exacerbating existing harms. We've seen how, for example, there has been this ongoing conversation around online sexual abuse and violence for decades, and now we're seeing how that's been, you know, only amplified and supercharged by the emergence of deepfake porn. You know, we saw Taylor Swift victimized by deepfake porn only a couple of weeks ago, and I think that there have been so many cases of young people. There was a case in which, you know, girls as young as 12 and 13 in a small village in Spain were victimized in a similar situation. And so we're seeing how AI is creating new technological avenues for these sorts of harms in a way that is lower cost and more sophisticated and more readily accessible than has ever been possible before. And so I think focusing on those areas where AI is exacerbating existing harms and making sure that we are, you know, using this momentum in one space to build off on the other space, I think is going to be really important. I mean, I think also Emma made a really important point, which is that these conversations have to be borderless because the harms that we're experiencing are borderless. You know, I talk a lot about this in the context of AI, but an AI product or model developed in the US can be fine-tuned by an adversary in, you know, the Middle East and can be deployed, you know, by an ally or adversary in Europe and so forth. You know, these products and these harms are borderless, and so our approach to regulation has to be borderless. I think we need to embrace international cooperation when it comes to AI and social media regulation. We saw some progress on this with the UK AI Safety Summit that took place last October, and we've seen some, you know, initial movement on trying to convene leaders from around the world to discuss the harms and opportunities posed by AI. But I think that, you know, it will take some work. It will take definitely the inclusion of young people. For example, the UN just inaugurated its, you know, first ever high level advisory body on AI, but most notably, it's, you know, missing any youth voices. And so I think that it's really important that as we are beginning to establish these global bodies and as we're beginning to even mull over ideas like creating an international regulatory agency for AI, we have youth who have a seat at the table in shaping those policy discussions. And so I think that, you know, my vision for the future will definitely involve this more international approach, considering how these harms are playing out across borders and how our solutions and our response should also play out across borders, and also really leaning into those areas where we are seeing emerging technologies like AI make the conversation around social media even more acute, and leaning on those tension points to really push forward political change.
And I know we don't have a lot of time left, so I'll make my remarks pretty quick. You know, I think what's really important is that we're talking about this on a macro scale right now. What are larger institutional changes that we can make to impact many? And I think oftentimes what's lost is at the micro level, you know, how does the individual feel? We asked you at the beginning, what is your screen time? We asked you, how do you feel when you're on social media? So I think it's really important that we continue to, with our organizations and with these movements, make space for the individual to have those moments, to feel as though they can find support, to open up conversations, destigmatize conversations regarding building better tech habits. And I think that all of our organizations are engaging with that in some regard, but it's incredibly important to remember that while we want to talk about institutional changes and legislation, we also want to protect the individual, those young people, anyone who's a user who feels as though they can build a better online experience through change.
Yeah, so well put. I'm super excited for the future, by the way, after hearing all that. I mean, at Rethink, I think we are really focused on two key trends in the cyber harassment space, which Sneha kind of, you know, spoke about. One is the globalization of this issue. When I first got into this work, you know, ICT use, that is, you know, technology use, was really confined to, you know, the US, the UK, Europe. Especially with the pandemic, ICT use has accelerated globally, and you have a lot of regions and places in the world where cyberbullying is exploding. And this is in contexts where mental health and related conversations are often very stigmatized, right, to your point. And so there aren't a lot of resources, there isn't even a vocabulary to start to have these conversations about how do we create a safer digital world. So focusing on those global communities is definitely our focus because, as you said, you know, the internet is ultimately an international entity, right? And that global perspective is so deeply important. We're also really going to be focused on image and video-based harassment because AI is absolutely fueling that. We've seen that with deepfake porn, but we've also seen just the automation of cyberbullying with images and videos. AI is enabling that, and it's getting more and more tricky to prevent that type of content, to trace that type of content. So figuring out how it is that we tackle that is going to be key. And the last thing I'll say, kind of to your point about, you know, focusing on the individual, we're really focused on thinking about how we can educate young people to live in the 21st century. You know, I find it striking. I went to school and I got handed a phone. No one ever told me, here's how to use this thing. It was just like push into the pool and figure it out. Do you know what I mean? And that, I think, is so odd, right? It's so odd that we do that to our young people. So we've invested a lot in internet education, digital literacy education, giving young people the skills they need to be a responsible digital citizen rather than letting them experience harm and figure it out on the other side. But I think the through line here, you know, if I can say so, is all of us are really hopeful for a vision in which we have an internet that young people deserve. And I think all of us believe that that internet is going to come from young people being at the forefront, shaping the conversation.
What a strong message there. Thank you. If we can round out with our last slide here, what are the ways that, if you have any last messages to share, how other people can support this movement, whether that's parents, young people, influencers on social media, and Simon, if you want to go ahead, you're welcome to.
Sure. So Emma touched on some of it already about making these conversations accessible. I think if you're a parent, have a conversation with your kids about what safe social media looks like. You don't have to have all the answers, but by simply engaging in that conversation, it pushes the needle forward because there's a recognition that, hey, these platforms might actually be unsafe. If you're an influencer with a platform on social media, talk about the ways, the trials and tribulations of your use of social media and spread the movement, share this vision and this mission, because you can be a productive influencer on social media who has safe social media and advocates for that. I think for the funders in this room, we've talked a lot about giving young people a meaningful seat at the table. If you're able to invest in youth-led organizations, I think we've demonstrated that we can and have achieved success. So continue to do that. Continue to back youth-led organizations. And then for the young people, you can join our movement. These organizations up here listed are organizations we all represent. Get involved. Reach out to us. We have websites. We have social media handles as well. Come get in contact with us. And then the last thing, the very last thing I'll say is that for policymakers, think critically about how you want to be remembered in the future, around whether you were on the right side of history when it came to advocating and advancing legislation to protect our generation online. There's a bipartisan bill in the Senate right now that could advance this year to protect our generation online. It would be the first social media regulation in 28 years that holds social media platforms accountable, that puts guardrails in place. Congress should pass that bill.
Thank you. I think we are at time with that one. That's a good closing message. I want to thank you all so much for attending this panel here today. I think maybe we'll stick around if anyone wants to have a quick conversation, but really, really appreciate all of your attention and sharing this time with us today, and hope you enjoy the rest of your Friday.
Thank you.